Europe moves forward
with big steps and small steps.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Monday, December 5th.
Coming up, lots going on around Europe today. We'll get the latest on the macro and the micro.
Should the head of an organization be held responsible when his employees misbehave?
And why did the chicken require Twitter after crossing the road?
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Well, there are a number of centers of attention when it comes to the European debt crisis this morning, and we'll start in Paris. You feel like you're in Paris, Steve?
No, I feel like I'm on a gondola ride.
Well, the leaders of France and Germany.
Let's have some beignets right now.
No. Maybe some croissants. The leaders of France and Germany have started a meeting in Paris this morning. They are planning an overall long-term strategy for the euro ahead of a key summit later this week.
All right, let's jump on over to Athens.
You're home. This is what they play every time you come home, Steve, right?
Dancing the Hasapiko right now, Jeremy. Athens, of course, is where you're going to find Vice President Joe Biden. He just told the new Greek government that the U.S. stands ready to help in any way possible as Greece tries to get its finances in order.
And finally, let's go to Italy. There we go. I'd like some pasta.
That's a spicy meatball.
Exactly.
Yeah,
well, Italy, of course.
Can't believe I said that.
It's a country that's too big to fail, Steve, but it's also too big to bail out. And the new leader, Mario Monti, is presenting a $40 billion package of budget cuts and tax increases to Parliament today. For more on that, let's bring in Isabella Bufacchi, a journalist with the financial newspaper Il Sole 24 Ore. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what exactly is Italy's new leader, Mario Monti, proposing this week?
The numbers are big. It is an austerity plan with spending cuts and tax increases. There are new taxes on wealth. They're reintroducing the property tax, which was just taken away recently on the first house. So it's a lot of measures that have two, let's say, ambitious objectives.
And I imagine that if a U.S. leader were to propose big tax increases and spending cuts like this on this scale, it would be very difficult for that person to get the public behind him or her. How difficult is it going to be for Monti to get all this through this week?
Well, it's going to be this week, and then probably some reforms will take a few more weeks till year end.
But still very quickly.
Yes, but I think there is a mix, and this is what Mario Monti is hoping, is saying, okay, there is a lot of sacrifices for some, but people who are not paying taxes or people are very wealthy, they're going to pay more.
Isabella Bufacchi with Il Sole 24 Ore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, now to the country with the fifth highest debt load in Europe. It's been without a full-time government, Jeremy, for 540 days. You calculate that, what is that? That's
more than a
year and a half, right? Or more. And I'm talking about Belgium. We don't have any Belgian music here, so we can't play anything. I don't even know what that could say. I would love to hear what Belgian music sounds like, actually. But it might, Belgium, get some leadership today with the appointment of a new prime minister. The BBC's Matt Cole reports now from Brussels.
It's been as much a source of amusement as anger here in Belgium that the country has gone so long without a government. There have been serious demonstrations calling on politicians to get their act together, but also more light-hearted protests. One group have refused to shave their beards until an administration is formed. A female lawmaker suggested the partners of her colleagues involved in negotiating a deal withhold conjugal rights until an agreement was reached. However, the critical stage of the European debt crisis may have forced a breakthrough. The six parties involved in talks have come to an agreement in principle to name Elio Di Rupo as the country's new prime minister. Here's Mr. Di Rupo trying to reassure markets that Belgium was still able to pass an austerity budget without a government.
We are proving that Belgium is capable of taking extremely difficult measures and that we are ready to face any kind of situation.
So right now, Belgium's got a budget, but no government. In Belgium, I'm the BBC's Matt Cole for Marketplace.
Well, let's check out the big picture when it comes to Europe as leaders try to come up with a solution to the debt crisis. The BBC's Andrew Walker is with us now from London with the latest on the European story. Hey, Andrew.
Good morning, Steve.
So ahead of this big meeting on Friday, what should we expect to see from French and German leaders at their meeting today?
I think we can expect them to agree the general direction they want to go in, which is to have a much stronger, more credible system of discipline over government budgets for countries in the Eurozone. But I think one of the things they're not going to resolve, my guess anyway, is they won't agree on exactly who should have the final say in enforcing it. The French President Sarkozy would like to have that done as a political thing, perhaps by leaders or finance ministers. The Germans want it done by the European Commission with the ultimate recourse to the European Court of Justice if necessary.
Is there a sense, Andrew, that we're actually going to get some solution to this problem? I mean, it seems like almost like a cat chasing its tail. You know, is anything happening here?
I think there's a distinct possibility that we will get some sort of decisions that will be conceived by the financial markets as being progress, but I don't think we're going to get the definitive solution, not least because if they do agree where they want to go at the end of this week, they still have a very difficult process amending European Union treaties, getting agreement by national parliaments, and in some cases getting them through referendums.
The BBC's Andrew Walker in London. Andrew, thank you.
My pleasure, Steve.
Well, for one more take today, let's bring in Julia Coronado. She is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Julia, let's start with the micro. The new Italian leader just proposed big spending cuts and tax increases that he wants to rush through the parliament there. Vice President Biden is in Greece today offering U.S. support as the Greeks try to sort out their finances. How important are these little individual events country by country?
Well, what we've learned is that all of these countries are in the same boat. So it's very important that each of these countries gain some credibility in their fiscal plans so that they don't cause problems for the countries around them. So it's both important to their own future as well as the future of other European countries.
And very little room for error for each one of them.
Absolutely. It's been, as we've seen, the market has been merciless in demanding a real, viable, and credible plan from these countries.
And what about the big picture? We've got the leaders of France and Germany in Paris today meeting, trying to come up with a big long-term plan for the euro ahead of a summit later this week. Is this another vital summit for the future of the euro or just another vital summit for the future of the euro?
Yeah. I know we all have a bit of the vital European summit fatigue, but you know, it is from the outside, from this side of the Atlantic. Sometimes it's a bit mystifying why we need to go through all of these, jump through all these hoops. But it's a complicated situation, and it's not easy to solve. The reason we get so many summits is that they are taking the bull by the horns and really trying to push this forward. So while that means more European news than we would probably like, it's a good indication that they're taking this very seriously and getting their hands dirty solving these problems.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Well, here at home this week, President Obama is expected to put the pressure on Congress to approve his nominee to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Richard Cordray was Ohio's attorney general, but Republicans vow to hold up any nominee until the bureau itself gets overhauled. Marketplace's Gregory Warner explains.
If Richard Cordray were to become director of the CFPB, he'd be independent of the White House and Congress. That scares Republican Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama, who said this to the Heritage Foundation.
You've got so much power vested in one person, unaccountable to Congress, unaccountable to really no one, someone that would be hard to remove.
GOP senators have vowed to block any nominee until funding for the bureau is under congressional control. Chris Cukwell from the Center for Responsible Lending says the bureau's independence is the whole point.
It's intentional in that it allows the bureau to be able to make decisions, and sometimes I think what may be tough decisions without having to worry about having their funding cut off.
The CFPB is open for business now. They're hearing complaints about credit card companies. Later this month, they want to hear about problems with your mortgage lender. But the Bureau needs Congress to approve a director before it can take on its policing role as Wall Street watchdog. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Well, a study out this morning says income inequality is at a record high, not just in the U.S., but around the world. That's according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Marketplace's David Gura has more from Washington.
The gap between the rich and poor has widened in developed countries pretty steadily over the last 30 years. Lane Kenworthy teaches political science at the University of Arizona.
There are a kind of common set of economic changes that have occurred, roughly speaking, since the 1970s.
One change was globalization. Companies now face more competition than ever, both here and overseas.
The increase in competition has made it a lot more important for firms to try to rein in labor costs or prevent them from rising.
And unions aren't as strong as they used to be. Technology has eliminated some jobs, and it's become a barrier for many people looking for work.
Technology has rewarded more those with high level of skills compared with those with relative low level of skills.
Stefano Scarpetta wrote the report. He says taxes and benefits can play a big role in reducing income inequality, but tax rates have gone down for high-income earners in many countries. And as countries cut back, social programs may be the first to go. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Congress is expected to continue debate this week on a payroll tax cut that goes away at the end of the year. Republicans want smaller cuts or none at all. Democrats want to pay for the cuts with a tax on wealthy Americans. But Fortune magazine's Alan Sloan says, as it stands now, the tax cuts are already helping wealthier people, including himself. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
So how has the payroll tax cut worked in the past?
Oh, it's worked by magic.
Magic?
Yeah. The government takes $112 billion or so of Treasury securities and puts them into the Social Security Trust Fund for the money not going into the fund. And then for the cash not coming into the government went out and borrowed another $112 billion. Piece of cake.
Piece of cake. All right. So who's benefiting the most from these payroll tax cuts? I mean, are we talking about poorer people getting the benefits, the majority of them, or middle class, wealthy people?
Well, actually, we're talking about people like me who were paid north of $100,000 a year because I got from the current cut roughly $2,000, and the average employee got maybe $800, $700, $600, 2% of whatever his wages are.
This is extra money in your pocket, right? That's not being taken out of your paycheck.
That is correct, and I'm glad to have it.
What would happen if these tax cuts were allowed to expire at the end of the year, if they just went away?
Well, there'd be a lot less money being spent by people who really need these cuts to keep going. It wouldn't make any difference to me, but it would make a difference, I suspect, to the economy. If you look at what's going on, there's a big fear that if you eliminate this tax holiday, you're going to cut spending substantially by consumers.
Should we be thinking about tax cuts with all these painful budget cuts that we have up ahead?
Well, if you want to stimulate the economy by putting money in, which is what they're supposedly doing, this is a pretty good way to do it because you put it in, it'll get spent, it's simple, and it goes away in a year.
Fortune magazine's Alan Sloan in New York. Alan, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
All right, so Jeremy, back to the program now. Where do you plan to do most of your holiday shopping?
I would say I'm going to do a lot of it online because it's just easier and, you know, yeah, exactly.
And you've got family like all over the place,
yeah,
right?
It's so, buy it, click it, send it, done.
Done. Done for Jeremy. All right. Well, I always think of big malls during the holiday season. I've done that for a long time, obviously, filled with tinsel and all kinds of sales. And Travel and Leisure just came out with a list of the most visited malls in the country. Yeah. Number one, and this is probably no surprise, the Mall of America.
Of course, in
right
Minnesota,
outside of the Twin Cities, right, with an estimated 40 million visitors per year. Can you believe that? That place is huge.
Well, in today's Midday Extra, we ask, are malls still a big deal this holiday season? And here to talk with us is Faith Hope Consulting, chairman of the retail group at Prudential Douglas Elliman. She's with us from New York. Hi, Faith.
Hi, good morning, Faith. Everyone. How are you?
So is this are malls still the thing? Do people still go to malls?
Oh, absolutely. It's part of the experience. Yes, I agree there's a lot of shopping online, but this is a country of shopaholics, and to get the enthusiasm, the buzz, people still go to the malls. They go for the experience. They go because there's other things to do in the malls, dining, entertainment. So there's something for the whole family. So while one person in the family is shopping, another is bowling, another is going to the movies. So it's an experience. It's not just about the shopping, but it's about everything that goes along with it. And that's why these malls have such attraction.
You know, it's interesting to me, Faith, because it's not only a question of whether we're shopping at brick and mortar places, mm-hmm. right? But also the types of malls have changed over the years, right? We're not talking about, I mean, there are a lot of indoor shopping malls. I think we mentioned the Mall of America and these others. But there are also these like lifestyle centers, right, where you just drive up to the store. They're all, it's sort of like a big strip mall, but it's, you know, they're fancy and you can walk around, but you're outside. It's not like an enclosed shopping mall.
That's true. And the lifestyle malls, and there's something going to come out. In fact, this is the week we're attending the shopping center convention here in New York City. Yeah. And actually, it starts today, and we're going to be seeing the next generation of the lifestyle malls, because the mall developers have to come out for something new, fresh to attract people. But the lifestyle malls, you drive right up, you feel like you're almost on Main Street near your home. It's a very, very pleasant experience.
Has it hurt the indoor mall, Faye?
Not at all. It's just a different type of shopping. In fact, today there really is no pure shopping. Just like the cyber shopping, a lot of people do shop online, but a lot of people do their research online. Then they go into the mall to actually buy the merchandise. So no one shops purely. No one shops in a downtown. No one shops just in an enclosed mall. There are discount shopping malls. Actually, on the list is Sawgrass, which is like a number one tourist attraction and probably the number one mall in the country for outlet shopping. But there's another one here in the Northeast area called Woodbury Commons.
Yep.
And when you get off, you try to get off the exit on the thruway, it's usually backed up anywhere from 6 to 10 miles, and that's every day until Christmas.
How many days do you spend in the mall per year, Faith, in the course of your research?
I'm afraid to tell you, but I and shopping because I turned a habit into a career. I am in one or two malls every single week locally, and then once a month I fly to different cities. So I'm in hundreds of malls. I have to have my feet on the street. You can't tell me what's going on in a mall. You can go in and feel the energy, because I also consult on what's missing. I mean, we consulted for the Mall of America, and we told them, oh, you need to put a wedding chapel, you need to put a ski slope. And they looked at us like we're crazy. Right now, we're working on what was the biggest mall before Mall of America, which is in Edmonton, and that's just been taken over. And they are re-tenanting that mall, and in fact, it's the same owners that have recently come in to upscale the Mall of America to give them more luxury because of all the tourists.
You mentioned Woodbury and the 6 mile pileup, that at the exit and all that. I mean, does that last? You said through Christmas, but I mean, do we see are malls doing all right through the rest of the year?
Most of the year, you're shopping there, because almost every holiday, and in fact, ones I wasn't even sure about, not the big holidays, but even the local holidays from Columbus Day to Veterans Day, they're running promotions all the time. You know, shop in our store and you dine for free, parking for free. Now they've got valet parking, because that particular mall is completely outdoors. So they have to create some incentive to bring people in the rain and in the snow. So there is always traffic there. And in fact, that's a hugely successful mall. So I think that the malls owners are doing a lot to try to keep up with today. They know that online presents some competition to them, but they have to keep creating a better experience and more excitement.
Faith Hope Consolo, chairman of the retail group at Prudential Douglas Elliman Real Estate. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Faith.
Bye-bye, and happy shopping.
All right, Jeremy, Faith, for the person with everything, let's talk about the perfect holiday gift, shall we? A water-powered jetpack. that'll zoom
that
you up
fun.
30 feet above water. I mean, I've seen them before, right? You like hold on to this thing and like bust you up through the, I don't know, stratosphere. But this will take you 30 feet, and you can float at thrilling speeds of around 5 miles an hour. The inventor is a guy named Raymond Lee, and he said he's been wanting one of these since he saw one as a kid in a James Bond movie. The jetpack runs about $100,000.
Wow.
That's a lot of money. But that's just for the basic model that comes in, I think, white or black or red. If you want flashier paint, that's going to cost you an extra $3,500.
You know, I've wanted a jetpack ever since I saw the devastation it caused on the show Arrested Development when young George Michael was...
Oh, man. President Obama meets at the White House today with a small group of university and college presidents. They're trying to figure out how to reduce the cost of higher education. But what can the president, or really the federal government, actually do to force college tuition down? Here's Marketplace's Steve Henn.
Well, not much. Maybe a stern lecture, some embarrassment. But David Brenneman, an economics professor at the University of Virginia, says colleges themselves could do a lot to reduce tuition and preserve quality education if that becomes a priority.
Most college presidents are hired for their supposed ability to raise revenue, not manage costs down.
Brenneman is a former college president himself. He says cutting costs is tough. It creates fights.
And frankly, if there's any hope for getting costs under control, it's going to come from some form of technology involvement.
This semester at Stanford, Professor Peter Norvig tried an experiment. He opened up his class to anyone online for free.
Maybe we'll get 10,000 people, and I said, nah.
In the end, 140,000 students from all over the world signed up. Norvig hopes this is just the beginning of what tech can do for higher ed. Maybe more paying students could lead to lower prices. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
If I had to come up with a word for the month we just had, it might be accountability. If you think about it, Steve, the leaders of Greece and Italy stepped down because of public anger. Mm-hmm. We had the coach of Penn State forced out because of the child abuse scandal there. Yeah. And now there are calls for the chancellor of the University of California, Davis, to leave office after police pepper sprayed those student protesters. Well, for more on the subject of accountability, let's bring in Jeffrey Sonnenfeld. He heads the Chief Executive Leadership Institute at the Yale School of Management. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Well, first of all, are you surprised by all of these people at the top of these organizations being asked to step down because of trouble far down the chain?
No, not at all. That's the whole idea of accountability. That's why the great sociologist Weber created the notion of bureaucracy, which he intended it to be as a good word, as a notion of justice instead of just capricious bullies making random decisions. You have a system of accountability. That's why somebody rises up and is paid the big bucks to be the boss, is they have to create a system where there is that accountability.
We've got this situation in University of California, Davis, where there was this pepper spray incident. A couple of police officers pepper sprayed some Occupy protesters. And now there are calls not for the police chief, but the chancellor of the university there to resign.
Well, you just wonder what her role was and what are the orders that were given to them. And you wonder how police captains could take this on with their own authority or, you know, the negligence of coaches and athletic directors in the other situations. Without the president knowing, and they also have an obligation to be diligent, that this negligence is no excuse.
Do you then risk micromanagement if you have this person at the top who's very worried about what might happen underneath them?
There's nothing more important than the university manages than its reputation, its image, its moral character. What else would be more macro managing? What's more important, the school colors?
Is there a difference in how you handle something like this or the responsibility that is given to the head of a university versus a corporation or some other kind of an organization?
Yes, it's scarier because you're set up as a pillar of integrity in society, number one. Number two, they have young people there. And number three, they also have police power. Very few, if any, corporations really have the delegated state authority of police forces to do some pretty horrendous things. All three of these qualities are, I think, what make a university president on heightened alert. This is what they should be learning instead of how to hold more football pep rallies.
Jeffrey Sonnenfeld heads the Chief Executive Leadership Institute at the Yale School of Management. Mr. Sonnenfeld, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And finally, Steve, to the UK, where an 11-year-old boy lost his pet chicken who went by the name of Ginger.
Oh, yeah. I love Ginger Chicken.
That's inappropriate, Steve.
No, I'm sorry.
Well, after scouring the neighborhood for it, his mom turned to Twitter. And according to the Northampton Chronicle and Echo, her plea for help was retweeted by a user here in the U.S., and the chicken was found.
Yay!
Right across the road. So the neighbor saw the chicken was lost on Twitter. And
wait,
then
and the chicken had to cross the road. Oh, no.
I don't know why
really,
the chicken crossed
joke.
The road. That's not that wasn't in the 140 characters. That didn't get in there.
The chicken was lost, and it was through like a United States, an American intermediary,
yeah,
that this chicken
right.
was then found.
Don't ever let anyone tell you that Twitter has not helped in chicken-human reunification efforts.
I think this is a great thing. Absolutely. And I'll make no bone about that. So,
in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Monday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.